You know the gentleman whose picture you tweeted to me this morning?
Oh, yes, yeah, that gentleman. Yes.
He blocked me on Twitter about 6 months ago for pointing out... he blocked me for pointing out that there's no apostrophe in Dexy's Midnight Runners. And as my wife said, it's sort of what you want that person.
Oh, yeah.
What you want that gentleman to do, to react quite so...
That's what Brusque. It does.
Neither in Dexy's nor indeed in Finnegan's, as you discovered to your cost, mate.
Yeah. Thanks.
No apostrophe in Howard's End, Dexy's Midnight Runners or Finnegan's Wake.
Does that mean they're not belonging to those particular people?
Correct.
They're just names. They are separate clauses. There's that thing in Steven Pinker book about the Toronto Maple Leafs. It's a brilliant explanation of why they're not called the Toronto Maple Leaves. Because they're named after the maple leaf, so they're the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Ah.
And the possessive is the Toronto Maple Leafs apostrophe, and so on and so forth.
That's not just because they were named by a bunch of French people who didn't care.
It's because they're a football team and they can't read. It's actually spelled M-A-L-P.
There's now no apostrophe in Waterstones either, which still causes me deep pain every time I see that.
There's a lot of fuss about that on the internet.
But, I know it's annoying to be fussed, but it is actually, his name is Tim Waterstone.
It's a decisive break with the past.
Yeah, particularly
ditching an apostrophe.
As though that's going to make any difference.
What's W.H. Smith's? Where's the apostrophe in there?
Oh,
is there one?
Oh, yeah, I think there is.
Where's the apostrophe in Earl's Court and Baron's Court?
Yeah, no, we're going to
come on, gents.
On the district line, surely.
One has an apostrophe and the other doesn't, but I can't remember which is which now.
W.H. Smith is called W.H. Smith now. People call it W.H. Smith as one word. I've seen people say, I went into W.H. Smith.
And that is what it is.
So it's
not always Smith. W.H. Smith and Son Limited.
Do you think Boots will eventually become Boot?
Boot.
In a similar way.
So they were quite smart. They thought, I don't want to be called Boot. Boot sounds really good.
Jay Sainsbury.
Then you get things like Tesco's, which isn't a name. Like a person.
Yeah, Tesco's.
Alan Tesco.
Nicky Tesco.
Sainsbury's has got an apostrophe. Well, used to, anyway. I think that's enough,
crackling.
Really. On
crackling
fire today. Absolutely on fire.
Joined us.
Welcome to an hour on the apostrophe.
Don't.
With my friends, John Mitchell.
The Pedants' Revolt, yes.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Backlisted, a podcast sponsored by Unbound, the website where readers and writers come together to make great books. We're actually sitting in the library of Unbound recording this. And I'm John Mitchinson, publisher of Unbound, and...
Hello, everyone. I'm Andy Miller. I'm the author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. We are Leavis and Butthead. We're joined, as ever, by our young friend, Matthew Clayton, the writer Matthew Clayton. Hello, Matthew.
Hello. I think I should be called M.S. Clayton today.
Yes. M.S. Clayton. Certainly,
In honour of our...
And our special guest today is David Quantick.
DJLP Quantic.
Ooh. Ooh.
DJLP Quantic. That's like Anthony Valerian John Cheatham, the publisher.
Ooh.
What's the LP?
Le Page. My great-grandfather was a ferry captain from the Channel Islands, and my great-grandmother lived in Plymouth, so all the men in my family have Le Page as a middle name because one of my ancestors mistakenly believed that by doing so they would be left a vast amount of money by some rich people in the Channel Islands. We're still waiting for it.
And while we wait...
We toil away.
We're going to be discussing the novel Christy Mallory's Own Double Entry by B.S. Johnson. But before we get on to that, John, what have you been reading this week?
I've been reading and enjoying hugely a book called On Silbury Hill by Adam Thorpe. Now, Adam Thorpe is a novelist and is probably best known for his first novel, which has kind of become a modern classic called Ulverton.
And that is a wonderful, wonderful book.
Yeah, and which was kind of he basically told the story of a Berkshire village, more or less from the, I think it was the 17th century through to modern times, using the voice, the dialect, different characters. It was a sort of modernist approach to telling a very rural tale. And it was interesting to me because it was disliked intensely by Salman Rushdie.
It's also now Nausgaard's favourite British novel.
Is it really?
Because he says it's not like a British novel.
Well, we had a huge row when I was judging many years ago the Best of Young British Novelists 1993 with Mr. Rushdie. And I was amazed because I thought he would love it. I mean, I brought it to the table as my best offer for books that had been published in recent times. And he didn't like it. He just said, the pastoral is dead. And I rather thought, well, yes, maybe, but that's the whole point about this book. Anyway, I haven't read all of Adam's novels since then, but this is easily the best thing I've read by him since. I absolutely adore it. It's a meditation. It's a memoir by the excellent publisher Little Toller, who publish a lot of books in this area. And I guess it positions itself in this interesting moment that we seem to have, is people writing essays about landscape, about history and the past. It's a memoir on one level of his growing up, and he travelled around a lot when he was a kid. His parents were all sort of from India and Africa. But he went to school at Marlborough, and he also grew up in the suburbs. And it's his relationship with a landscape, and particularly with this one extraordinary, possibly the most extraordinary prehistoric monument anywhere, Silbury Hill, which is a man-made hill built with antler pixes and bits of chalk hewn out of the ground and made into a... it's several hundred feet high. It's huge. It's the, as he says at one point, if you had, as it were, the Statue of Liberty behind it, you'd only be able to see the Statue of Liberty's torch. And we have absolutely no idea why it was built.
I sent you a link to a Julian Cope song
yes, I did.
Called By the Light of the Silbury Moon,
yeah.
which is terrific. And, of course, he writes about Silbury Hill a lot, but not in the way Adam Thorpe does.
Well, Adam Thorpe, it's great. It's got elements of history. It's got elements of memoir, as I've said. It's got all the speculation. It was a big... There was a book in the 70s by Michael Daines, which basically was all part of the sort of this idea that all of these in that area, Avebury, Stonehenge, Silbury, that the whole thing was a massive astronomical kind of calculator. And there are definitely some elements of that that are still being... But there's no... They've dug into it several times, and they found really nothing inside it except for interesting clay and interesting remains of insects. So, and it was obviously it wasn't the same size. It was built in stages. It was smaller and then grew larger.
I think it's full of jam.
Yeah. Well, that would be fun.
It's a theory.
It's just a theory.
Yeah.
But to be honest, it's almost as good as most of the theories. But I guess that's the thing. It's, if you're interested, you know, if you're interested in any kind of meditation on the past and what the past is, I mean, Adam Thorpe, right? He writes beautifully.
Adam Thorpe's not just a novelist, we should say as well. Yeah. He's a poet, and he's written plays, and he's translated Madame Bovary, and
he wrote a whole play in Berkshire dialect for which some cred must be given.
When Ulverton came out, it's when I was working at Waterstones in Earl's Court. Don't look for it. It's not there anymore. It's been razed to the ground. And we did an event with Adam Thorpe. He was ever so nice. And in order to ensure... Because clearly nobody really knew who he was when that novel came out.
No, so, it came really pretty much out of left field for most
people.
To
ensure that some people came, Hilary Mantel, very generously and off her own bat, had said to him, if you are doing any events in London, let me know and I'll come and introduce you and interview you. So we did this event with Hilary Mantel and Adam Thorpe. She loves that novel. I think she said that's her favourite novel of the last 30 years or something as well. Then she published A Place of Greater Safety and Flood. I think those were the only two books that she published. But it was still a big deal for her to come and very generously front up for him. So,
well, as I say, the mystery of the hill itself is unsolved, but he writes so beautifully around it. Just give you a little tiny bit of the... which he says, perhaps nothing as spectacular and lovely has ever been created since on our islands. No work of art or architecture or technological achievement. And what we now have is a mere husk, which is a bit sad. But no, I couldn't recommend it highly enough. On Silbury Hill, Adam Thorpe by the excellent Little Toller Press. Andy.
Thanks.
What have you been reading?
When we talk about the books I've been reading, I normally talk about an older book, but I wanted to talk this week about a book that was only published last week, but just is
this
the
is
most...
to you in January 2015, just so you're...
Published,
if you're listening to this in 2050.
It's a book by Laura Cumming called The Vanishing Man, In Pursuit of Velazquez. Now, I knew that would happen, listeners. when I said Velasquez. So I'm just going to read. I'm just going to read what Laura says about this specific issue.
It's a very interesting point.
We are hesitant.
Hesitant. Sorry.
With Velasquez's name in English, wondering whether we have lisped it correctly. El Greco is easy to pronounce. Goya sounds as it looks. Van Gogh we have arrived at as right. something quite other than the Dutch pronunciation, yeah. a sort of harsh anglicisation that has long since settled into consensus. But Velázquez is uneasy in any version, properly Hispanicised or not Hispanicised. We do not mention him too often for all his transcendent genius. His is not a name on most people's lips. I thought this was going to be a book about Velázquez's painting. And it is a book about the painting. It's a biography, but it's also a biography with the story of a man called John Snare, a 19th century printer and
easy
bookseller.
Pronounce, very
John Snare.
In balance.
Snare.
Unless you're Galician. It's Juan Snare.
He was a printer, he was a bookseller from Reading who chanced upon a portrait of Prince Charles to become King Charles I. Right. In a country house sale, the discovery of which led him initially to fame and fortune and then to utter penury and disaster. So Laura Cumming tells the story of the painter, the story of the painting, the story of people who owned the painting, and furthermore a meditation on what art means at different points to different people of different classes. And I thought it was the most she writes beautifully. So yes. You start off, it's a delight to read. But as it goes on, the weaving of it into a real book rather than... I mean, there's a phrase that I've used a lot, which people do use a lot in the business, of a long magazine article.
Yeah.
And if this book didn't work, it would be a long and perfectly interesting magazine article.
That's
but
interesting.
It functions as a book in three dimensions. It's absolutely wonderful.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to say before that the Adam Thorpe is a monograph, which I kind of never really know what's the difference. It looks like a book. It's got chapters.
How many words is it, do you think?
I don't know. It's probably about 50,000. Sounds like a book to me. And that definitely looks like much more than a long article.
This book is probably about 100,000 words. And there are plenty of books around which are about 100,000 words, which nonetheless are...
Yeah.
Which seem like very long magazine articles because they don't accumulate, they don't add up to more than the sum of their parts.
But this is not one of them, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, this is incredible. And I mean, I'm making this a hostage to fortune. I'd be very surprised if this doesn't win a prize or two. And I would love people to read it because actually the balance between, you know, history and storytelling and critical theory is a thing that lots of people try. And relatively few people can pull off and make page turnings.
But Velázquez is interesting, because he's one of those painters that you hear people always saying he's the greatest painter of all time, the best, he's absolutely the best, which is interesting because you look and you think, quite good. That looks like a painting of a Spanish nobleman and that looks like a painting of some Spanish children. But it's only when you get them really sort of talking to you about, you know, his technique and his brush strokes and all that sort of, which is fine. I mean, I'm prepared to take it on face value, not as an art critic. But I did go to the Prado, Prado, in Madrid. And
this is just silly now.
To see the Goya, amongst other things. But I did find, actually, in the end, I came out of that thinking, I don't know what it is about Velázquez. It's weird. The paintings themselves, the physical things themselves, are pretty astonishing.
She's so... One of the things that's so inspiring about this book is she's absolutely wonderful at relating her own experience of seeing the paintings in the flesh. And indeed, that's the starting point of the book, the thing you've just described. Of going into the Prado and seeing the painting hanging there. But actually, she's brilliant as well at painting, no pun intended, a picture of you of the world in which you couldn't just look on the internet.
No.
And if you wanted to go and see a painting, you had to make long, arduous journeys to other countries in order to stand there and see it and never be able to see it again, to try and take the memory away with you. One of the ways in which the book really inspired me is it made me think, well, you know, I'm in my late 40s. I might have another 20 years, on average. On average. There's at least half a dozen paintings that I love that I've never seen that I would love to, you know, go to Chicago and stand in front of La Grangeat and see La Grangeat rather than...
The year of looking dangerously, here we come.
Yeah. That's the other thing about monographs. They don't fund trips to Chicago. In my experience, perhaps Adam Thorpe's has a different one, I don't know. But
Labours of Love, I think.
Yeah, Labours of Love. Anyway, so that's The Vanishing Man by Laura Cumming, and that is a wonderful, wonderful book.
We'll pick this up again after some adverts. Stay tuned to this.
B.S. Johnson, who was, for a period at least, one of the most famous and feted English novelists, took his own life at the age of 40 in 1973.
Yeah, there's a wonderful biography of B.S. Johnson by our former guest on Backlisted, Jonathan Coe. The biography is called Like a Fiery Elephant. And just before we start, I'm going to read just a paragraph from that, which if anyone listening doesn't know who B.S. Johnson was, this will place him. This is what Jonathan Coe says about B.S. Johnson. He says, Brian Stanley Johnson was, if you like, Britain's one-man literary avant-garde of the 1960s. At least publicly, anyway. He was a working-class Londoner born in Hammersmith in 1933, whose childhood was defined by the trauma of wartime evacuation and his failure to pass the 11+. He worked in banking and accountancy and as a teacher before winning places at Birkbeck College and King's College London. In the space of 10 years, he wrote 7 novels, of which the one we're going to talk about today, Christy Mowry's own double entry, was his 6th. And the last published in his lifetime. And in addition, he wrote poetry, plays, wrote or directed more than a dozen short films. He was a sports reporter too, and a reviewer and a polemicist, and he worked tirelessly for the trade union movement, making documentaries and propaganda films. He died by his own hand at the age of 40. And in fact, although he's known as a novelist now, first and foremost, he was doing all these other things at the same time. And it's worth saying that he wrote 7 novels in 10 years.
Yes,
7 pretty extraordinary novels in various ways, which we'll come on and talk about. But David, you said to me earlier that Christy Mowry's own double entry is your favourite, all-time favourite novel.
Yeah, it just combines so many things that I like. It's quite scary, it's very funny, it's quite short, I like that as well. People have sneered at it before. It's an experiment in form, which I enjoy.
Yeah.
It's a great story. It's quite, as I say, terrifying at point. It just seems to fit every... It's a great... Yeah, every criterion for a book for me.
Shall we do the blurb?
Yeah.
Here it is. This is off the 2001 Picador edition, which we think is a very good blurb. We're pleased with this one. Christy Mowry is a simple man. His job in a bank puts him next to, but not in possession of, money. As a clerk, he learns the principles of double-entry bookkeeping and adapts them in his own dramatic fashion to settle his personal account with society. Under the column headed aggravation for offences received from society, unpleasantness of bank manager, general diminution of life caused by advertising, debit Christie under recompense for offences given back to society, general removal of items of stationery, pork pie purveyors limited bomb hoax, credit Christie. All accounts are to be settled in full, and they are in the most alarming way. B.S. Johnson was one of Britain's most original writers, and Christy Mallory's own double entry is his funniest book. And then there's a great quote. This is weird. They've taken this off the newest, latest edition. A most gifted writer, Samuel Beckett. And the future of the novel depends on people like B.S. Johnson, Anthony Burgess. Do you think that is because Samuel Beckett and B.S. Johnson are less well known than Oberon Wall?
Actually, in the Jonathan Coe book, it explains that. It says that Samuel Beckett objected to being quoted on the blurbs of B.S. Johnson's books.
And also that Johnson spent his life, is clear from Like a Fiery Elephant, telling seemingly in every letter that he wrote to anyone, quoting Beckett, to tell people how great he was. in a endearing manner, I have to say. But
also Beckett was like Stephen King of his day. Every book had something by him. Yeah, a fantastic... Carol Robbins, a fantastic read, Samuel Beckett. Once I had picked up The Spy Who Loved Me, I could not put it down, Samuel Beckett. Yeah. Watership Down made me cry, Samuel Beckett.
If anyone is listening to this can settle a small bet, I'm willing to wager that excellent blurb was written by Peter Strauss.
Yeah, well, it's good. It's good. It's better than the latest one. I'm prepared to say that.
Okay. But, right.
Having said that, I think credit where credit's due, Picador are to be commended for bringing back. I think they've brought back four or five of B.S. Johnson's novels.
Picador have reprinted all the ones they are
able
the estate are happy for them to reprint.
It's the first uniform edition, I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah.
There were dribs. You could get Christy Mallory in the 1980s. You could get House Mother Normal.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was really... I mean, living now in a world where you can actually get almost everything by B.S. Johnson in any major bookstore or online is just a dream to me.
When did you first read Christy Mallory's?
It was about, I think it was 1976. It was in the local library. You know, there would be books in there that I liked as a teenager. And then you'd get something out just because you liked the name. And as I say, this was short. And it was just, I mean, Jonathan Coe has said that it fit his teenage worldview because it was surreal. It was like Python or The Goons. And there is that sense of humour. There's that fourth wall thing. You know, when you're a teenager, you love the fact he keeps breaking cover and addressing you directly. So the humour and the darkness and the anarchy. Yeah,
I thought it was really full of anarchy. It felt like something that, you know, if I would... You know, I only read it this week, but I would have loved to have read it in 1976, 1977, because it must have had real power then, I imagine.
It's one of those books that they're very rarely where you get something that's as short. There's not a single unenjoyable moment in this book, which is, God knows, that's rare. The extraordinary thing, it does all those things you're saying, David, but it does it without being, you know, he hated the word experimental, because that was always used as a sort of a stick to beat his work with. But it's just playful, isn't it? That's what I loved about it. It's just you think, here's somebody who's absolutely has thought more about the novel than almost anybody else, but is still able to create a brilliant narrative about a completely recognisable 17-year-old when he starts the novel, working in a tedious, first of all, a bank and then in a tedious factory. But he makes the factory... Almost. That's what the detail of going from all the different departments. He writes brilliantly about that, I think.
And the other thing is that all B.S. Johnson's books are also about A, books, B, writing books, and C, B.S. Johnson. But in a way which is successful. It could be terrible. David was talking about the breaking the fourth wall. I'll only read a couple of sentences here, but this is the start of a typical chapter. An attempt should be made to characterise Christie's appearance. I do so with diffidence, in the knowledge that such physical descriptions are rarely of value in a novel.
It's fantastic. One of the great things about it is, yes, there's personal experience in it. These are jobs that Johnson had. There is a degree of affection for his factory years, you're quite right. But at this point in his career, you know, biography isn't that important to a novel. It doesn't matter entirely. Even with B.S. Johnson, it's not entirely relevant what he had for breakfast and how he was feeling. But at this point of his career, you know, he's going to be dead soon at his own hand, as you said. But there's none of that in this book. This book has got bitterness at society. It's a revenge novel. It's about a sociopath. It's probably full of things that Johnson wanted to do to people. But it's a frothy book.
Yeah.
It's a light read. It's like if American Psycho had been written by Noel Coward. There's my blur.
That is genius. But I love that. But I love a bit of escalation in a novel. And it does escalate from making a mark on a building to, by the end, without giving too much away, mass murder of a whole London suburb.
It's one of the things that he was so brilliant at, though, is taking an idea and seeing it through. We'll talk about some of the other novels in a minute, but the idea that you would take an idea and logically progress it to mass murder. That's a very B.S. Johnson thing to do.
That key idea is, in a way, it's a satire on the whole. He takes double entry accounting, bookkeeping, and uses that. I mean, it's a brilliant device in a novel, the idea that the perceived slights, it's a moral double entry. He feels he's been dissed by people. So he has to, in order for the books to balance, he has to do something to balance it up. But of course, by the end of the book, he's severely in credit against society at large. What's the brilliant thing about socialism that he puts in towards the end, which he puts in vast amount of money, that the unrealisability of socialism is basically that society owes him for that.
Yeah.
I also just love the madness of, like, the death of his mother. It's this brilliant kind of monologue, which apparently his mother, I think, had died or at the time the book was written, or maybe died shortly afterwards, but it was...
After Christie, it was meant to be a trilogy, starting with See the Old Lady, Decently.
Yeah. Yeah.
the titles all add up. I can't see the old lady decently buries up. It's meant to be a monograph about England and about his mother's death and an autobiography. So, yeah, obviously that's in his mind at this point. But the death of his mother, which is the bit I'll be reading in a bit, is just... it's a fantastic piece of writing. There's no point describing it.
So I'm just going to run through the novels that lead up to this one very quickly. As I say, they were written in the space of about 10 years. The first one is called Travelling People.
A fantastic book. It's the most conventional book that he wrote, the one that he and his estate don't want published again, which is fantastically annoying unless you're rich.
Well, thanks to our friend and colleague Scott Pack, we have a copy of Travelling People here, which he has very kindly borrowed from the London Library, because it will set you back, as you say, about £200 to buy a copy. I wonder why they won't... Why even the estate won't let it be reproduced. I know why Johnson didn't want it reproduced.
I think the estate
didn't like it.
Respectful to his wishes. I mean, it's a brilliant book, but it is... It's kind of not typical of what he wanted. It's equivalent of, like, a really cool electronic band releasing a set of blues songs that they wrote when they started.
It's
beautiful novel.
It's
a conventional novel. It's brilliantly written. It's very autobiographical, which is a very Johnson thing. But I think from his point of view, anybody could have... He probably thought it was too easy.
Well, also, yeah, it has different chapters written in different voices. It has all black pages. But as he said, these weren't innovations. They were things that had been done by, for instance, Lawrence Stern in Tristram Shandy.
Yeah.
So he hasn't quite got to grips with the sort of novel he wants to write yet.
And yet it's a brilliant... That's the frustrating thing. If it was a crap book, you'd be like, oh, fair enough.
But
it's a really... It's one of his best books.
So that's written in 60. That's published in 63. That wins a prize. He then immediately writes another book published in 64 called Albert Angelo, which is a comedy based on his experience of being a teacher.
And is that the one that has got the cut out?
That is the one that has the hilariously, somebody was spoiling the plot of Christy Mowry on the internet this morning, and I was saying, he said, I've just read Albert Angelo, and I'm like, spoilers, because it is a book with a famous spoiler. Yeah, it cuts through to a quote from a play. And you, whilst reading the whole book, because it's a brilliant way, you're aware of the event. Now, if it was a film, you would have it on a little window in the corner of the screen, replaying.
So it has the whole cut in the page, but it also has the very famous, the first infamous and brilliant B.S. Johnson-ism is in this book, which is the phrase, I'll call this lying. Johnson believed and said frequently that telling stories is telling lies.
Yeah.
And the novel can only progress if it incorporates, honestly, that element of acknowledging that it's fake.
And this is the moment that it all starts to come apart, because essentially it's like a painter saying that paint is lies. Essentially what Johnson is doing... Johnson's a brilliant writer. He's really good at making things up. He's really good at telling stories and lying. But he's decided this is a bad thing. So essentially what he's saying, and this is where Trawl, the next novel, comes in, that a novel is transcription. In the end, a novel is writing, I am writing, and it becomes circular, self-eating. So in the end, a novelist is a man who's writing, I am writing a novel.
Yeah.
And Trawl, which I think is the next
that
one,
is, yeah,
is the one where he gets a job on a trawler so he can write a book about his experiences, even though he's never seen a fish in his life.
Fred Warburg of Secker & Warburg said to him, Brian, you can write these books, but I've signed you up to write novels. You're just going to deliver autobiographies.
Yeah, this is, this is true.
But he follows, Trawl with probably his most famous book, The Unfortunates, which is The Book in the Box.
The Book in the Box.
It has 27 chapters, 25 of which may be shuffled into any order you wish. It's, for what it's worth, it's my favourite of B.S. Johnson's novels.
It's probably the archetypal, you know, I mean, if we're going to use, I always use rock comparisons, it's the Sergeant Pepper or the Ziggy Stardust of his career, to be a bit naff. It combines all the great elements of his work, autobiography, experimentation, humour, emotion, because while he was someone who believed in playing with form, and telling the truth, he believed very much in emotion. It has a lovely trick in it where, you know, he's a sports writer, and the whole book centres around a moment where he's sent to watch a match in a town, and he suddenly realises he's been to this town before. This is the town where his friend Tony lived, Tony who became ill and died. And I believe, actually pasted, just having a quick check, in the book, right at the end, is the actual match report by B.S. Johnson, which is fantastic. Someone should do a collection of B.S. Johnson's football reviews.
They will.
And then fast. Gordon hit a fierce shot. The ball struck Mull's outstretched foot and went over Edson into the goal. The Unfortunates is fantastic.
The thing that Dave was saying there as well about the, how it's a really moving book, and there's a really interesting, slightly sniffy overview of Johnson's career by Frank Kermode. And Frank Kermode says of The Unfortunates, Johnson was such a good writer that his novels survived his quixotic attempts to ruin them for the reader. You know, the heart in what is quite an intellectual exercise in The Unfortunates and the evocation of a friendship in it is, to me, it's integrated brilliantly with the form in which they're not separate, you know.
That's sort of what impressed me. I'm just going to read a little bit just to show, because it's, you know, most experimentation has that terrible, sort of smells a bit of the lamp, you know, it looks for, oh, I'm being experimental because I want to say I'm being experimental. But with Johnson, it's almost like he can't, he's telling a story in an experimental way that somehow you're still reading in an enjoyable way as a reader. You don't feel, just this little bit where he goes to see the Shrike, his girlfriend, who's a brilliant character. They go to see the Shrike's old mum, and the old mum says this, kind of, she lives in Islington. Oh, it was worth it all those years of sacrifice just to get my daughter placed in a respectable novel like this, you know? It's my crowning achievement. And with only one leg, too. The Shrike's old mum suddenly took off an artificial limb which had hitherto been unapparent to Christy and waved it triumphantly. Stick of bombs it was, went on the Shrike's old mum. The first got St Mary's Church in Upper Street, the second got that brothel on the corner of Dagmar Terrace, and the third got me and my old man. The church, sex and marriage, observed Christy, laughing. That's too neat. That's how it happened, said the Shrike's old mum. You can't muck about with how it happened, can you? I'll have a word with you later about your obsession with knocking religion, said the Shrike to Christy, quietly and without venom. And now we must go, old mum. Sunday's the only day we have for a really long Cheerio, ring if you want us for anything. See you Tuesday night as usual. And who said we were married anyway? Shouted the Shrike's old mum after them, slowly lifting the leg to wave them goodbye. That is mad vertigo-inducing paragraph, but it completely works.
The thing is, so Christy Mallory and the book that precedes it, his last two novels published in his lifetime, they're both comedies. House Mother Normal, Christy Mallory's own double entry, they're both comedies. They're both ideas that he had at the time that he was writing Travelling People, back in 1963. And his own argument was always that the emotional need and autobiographical need to write Albert Angelo Trawl and the Unfortunates got in the way of him, you know, not writing those comic novels earlier. And in the case of both House Mother Normal and Christy Mallory, you can see there is it's almost like Johnson has set himself a puzzle. Can I create this ornate little box of a thing and make it play as a novel? Don't you think with House Mother Normal
House Mother Normal's amazing because it's far better than it needs to be. In that, essentially, it's the classic thing. It tells a story of, let's say, eight characters from different points of view. The same evening, the same actions, all seen from different POVs, of various elderly people in different states of physical and mental decline. That's fine. It's all fine. But page by page, it's exact moment to moment. Page two of one character's narrative is the same as page two of another character's narrative, and so on. He doesn't have to do that, but it's so you could overlay the pages. Yeah. If you could read through paper, he overlays the pages, and it all matches second by second. It must, you know, it probably took him a day, but it would take a normal human being years.
Yes,
it's so precise.
I mean, the thing is, as well, these books aren't available currently electronically, which is a shame, because it would be nice if they were available in ebook form. But also, like The Unfortunates and House Mother Normal, there's you know, they're like analog versions of things that would be done digitally.
If Brian Eno had written them. I mean, basically, since the invention of computer art, there's an awful lot of music and paintings online which do exactly what The Unfortunates does, which enable you to shuffle them around, view or listen to them in random or semi-random order, create works of art. And this is what Johnson was doing with paper. I mean, if I was staging plays, and thank God I'm not, they should just do it in live. Mm-hmm. Just go straight away, do it in a room, in a room like the one, which is basically a lot of people sat round an event in an old people's home. They should get the actors to learn it and just do it live, simultaneously.
So the House Mother Normal.
Yeah.
So you can wander
from person to person.
Yeah. A bit like Rogue,
or the Jim just do it as a radio thing. you know, just use stereo mixing and mix in and out.
There was a radio play adaptation of Christy Mallory's own double entry when it was published.
I think I've heard it.
Yeah. Have you heard it? Yeah, I'd love
who,
to hear
who read it.
He did.
He did.
Johnson
and,
read it with a couple of voices. That's Timothy. Right. And there's a thing with Timothy West, which is, I think, Down the Red Road, which is about, essentially, it's Mr. Creosote ahead of his time. It's a man eating and his stomach rebelling.
So we talked a lot about the experimental nature of what he did. I'd just love to read this very short thing from the introduction of a collection of his non-fiction called Aren't You Rather Young to Be Writing Your Memoirs, in which he tries to just say why he writes. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, this is why anybody writes, really. I'll just read it. I think I write because I have something to say that I fail to say satisfactorily in conversation in person. Then there are things like conceit, stubbornness, a desire to retaliate on those who have hurt me, parallel by a desire to repay those who have helped me, a need to try and create something which may live after me, which I take to be the detritus of the religious feeling, the sheer technical joy of forcing almost intractable words into patterns of meaning and form that are uniquely, for the moment at least, mine, a need to make people laugh with me in case they laugh at me, a desire to codify experience, to come to terms with things that have happened to me, and to try to tell the truth, to discover what is the truth about them. And I write especially to exorcise, to remove from myself, from my mind, the burden having to bear some pain, the hurt of some experience, in order that it may be over there in a book and not here in my mind. I mean, that's brilliant, really.
Yeah. As you say, what else really is there to say?
But unfortunately,
we have Matthew.
Well,
Is there a link?
This episode, I've got a genuinely tenuous literary link. And the genuinely tenuous literary link is that in Terry Pratchett's Discworld novels, there was a character called B.S. Johnson.
Good God,
no.
It stands for Bergholt Stutley Johnson, or, as he's better known, Bloody Stupid Johnson. Now, what I love about this is that there is absolutely no evidence that Terry Pratchett ever read B.S. Johnson. And actually, it's just a coincidence. What I also love about it is that if B.S. Johnson saw it, I know that he wouldn't think it was a coincidence. And he definitely write to Terry Pratchett.
Samuel Beckett.
Quoting Samuel Beckett, saying how incredibly angry it made him that it was a bloody stupid Johnson, because he wasn't bloody stupid at all. The rest of the world was bloody stupid.
He was also a great letter writer. I always imagine being B.S. Johnson's agent and just shrinking. Agents, plural. It was a great risk to offend B.S. Johnson. If he was with us now, he'd basically be walking into people's houses with machine guns, getting rid of Giles Corran and other people who've criticised him over the years.
There's this brilliant phrase from him referring to most other novelists who he called, quote, those Oxbridge bastards. Not only are your novels not as good as mine, but you haven't even started. I mean, you know.
He did have some serious chip, didn't he? I mean, he honestly believed he was doing something special, different, new, better, and didn't have a lot of truck with what he called the literary establishment. Although it seems to me the literary establishment seemed to quite like his stuff. I mean,
Kermode refers to him in passing as, quote, a large and genially argumentative presence. He made a film about Samuel Johnson, one of the things, and one of the praises that he lays at Samuel Johnson's door is Samuel Johnson could win an argument with anyone.
Yeah.
You know, the Don to the heckler in a barge on the Thames. And I think Johnson is often arguing to convince not other people but himself. He loves the idea of his own.
He can certainly start an argument with anyone.
Yeah.
One of my favourite moments is that he talks about the concept of the human brain and the things that we can perceive. And he says, there are limits to human intelligence. And somebody's saying, well, what about aliens? He goes, aliens? Yes, you're thinking of a dragon with six legs. Something on those lines. It's just, he was feisty. And I think his consumption of alcohol did not diminish this in any way. Mm.
Was he the literary equivalent of the footballer that Alex Ferguson said could start a fight in an empty room?
I think B.S. Johnson didn't even need a room. I think he could start a fight with air.
David, do you want to
I do indeed.
Bring it back to Christy Mallory for us, please?
Yes, is this where I read?
Yes.
Yes, excellent. I'm going to read the whole damn thing. This is Chapter 3. It is a Shandy-esque moment. Chapter 3, Ave Atque Vale to Christie's mother. I won't explain anything at this point. Christie lived with his mother at this point near Hammersmith Bridge in the stump of Mall Road left after the flyover and associated highway improvements. When he arrived home on this day, time now being more or less continuous, his mother rose and welcomed him. Then she delivered herself of a statement, thus: "My son, I have, for the purposes of this novel, been your mother for the past 18 years and 5 months to the day, if I assume your conception to have taken place after midnight. Now that you have had your great idea and are set upon your life's work, there is nothing further for me to do." Christie's mother paused, then continued, "I do not complain. I have every reason to be satisfied with what I have done. I have cared for you without cosseting, cooked sensibly for you, without running risks from whatever disease was fashionably connected with food at each of several times. Those parts of my body, under taboos ruling over the last quarter of a century, have not been exposed to you since at least the age of 3. I have, husbandless, brought you up not to miss a father, without damaging what they would call your normality. I flatter myself that you are yourself, that you are both more and less than what I have made you, if that means anything. Nor have I let your character be moulded by such other men as I have allowed, for I am not a wooden block, to cross my path and enter in at the shrine of my womanhood. The rather fanciful conceit is used to spare your blushes, Christie, for sons in general have to be over 30 before they can talk without embarrassment to their mothers about sexual matters. Or anything else I have sometimes, in moments of cynicism, thought." Again, the charming old lady paused, reflected, and went on. "I even allowed you to keep a pet, a cat, in order to encourage some kind of loving in you, despite the fact that Austin inevitably meant more work for me in skinning and braising the mice and other small creatures he regularly brought in. Fortunately for you, Austin passed it over 4 months before the occasion of this statement I am at present making, so you are thus spared, Christie, the expense of having him put to sleep at the veterinary surgery. But how I laughed when you first lisped, 'I do love pussy.'"
I think I'll leave it there.
Not above. Now, one of the things about Christie Mallory's own double entry, Dave, that I wanted to ask you, if you have a theory as to why Johnson does this. At various points in the novel, he uses gratuitously long and obscure words. Like, I've got a list of them here.
Oh, yeah.
Helmnuthoid, retropotent, campaniform, sufflamination, ungraith, brachiuriate, plus at least one, exeleutherosamize, which he seems to have made up, and when you Google it, comes up as used by B.S. Johnson in Christie Mallory's own double entry. Why does he do that?
I think he doesn't do it for the Will Self reason of thinking of a word to show, look, I know a word.
Yeah.
That's kind of a verbal tick. That's his catchphrase, like, can you hear me, mother? I think in the case of B.S. Johnson, what he's doing is, A, he's having fun. B, he knows that the literate reader will look it up. And so he's taking you out of the book.
You know that
you're going to stop reading, you're going to
find a dictionary. He's familiarising, isn't he? He's just kind of doing that little, are you paying attention? What?
And in fact, he does it with one word. Instead of, you know, he does it in so many different ways. He does all the Brechtian thing, the 18th
Absolutely.
Century thing, in which Christie discovers. He does the thing we've just seen with his mum, saying, I am now, talking to you directly, the reader. But doing that with one word is fantastic.
I agree.
It's not to trip. And the fact that there is that joke, that he's made up a word, which, in the proper comedy rule of three, you have a real word, you look it up, and then there's a word which doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So you're like, oh, B.S. Johnson, I hate you.
I love how I agree with you, there's that kind of shaking you out of the novel by the single word, and a kind of Brechtian thing. He even does the Brechtian thing in this novel by quoting Brecht. It's a way of breaking you out and reminding you this is a novel.
That's the classic, I do know what Fefremdum's effect is, mate.
Headland paused to provide a paragraph break for resting the reader's eyes in what might otherwise be a daunting mass of type.
That's
casually thrown in.
It's exactly why I love that book, because to me it's exactly like The Goon Show. It's like, it's like an old radio when people go, so what are we going to do now? I don't know, let's look at the script.
Definitely.
It's the Bugs Bunny thing of running
funny,
off the film.
It's funny, isn't it? It's at one end, it's pointing back to like Beckett's stories. And I always think of that, God help us all, it's an easy death. It is not. After that brilliant piece you're reading, it just ends with Christie's mother died. further elaboration needed.
Yeah.
So, but then it's also looking forward to sort of Python-type humour.
I mean, I think the humour of it is the thing that I think people like ourselves probably respond to in the
first instance. I read Albert Angelo actually quite recently. I just thought it was really funny. I mean, it was obviously all these other things as well. It's a brilliant experimental novel. It is a depiction of life as a teacher in the early to mid-1960s. Also, it's got a lot of very good jokes in it. And he doesn't pull his punches on the jokes. I mean, David, you write comedy, you know this.
I think the uniqueness of Johnson, outside the experimental or whatever you want to call it thing, is this brilliant combination of being very funny and very bleak. That this is, you know, Housemother Normal is something that couldn't be filmed, could possibly be filmed now, but very unlikely. Christy Mowry, if done properly, is a very, very sad book. The last page is just, it's a flipping whited sepulchre.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a skull on a hill, is what it is. And is that brilliant bleakness. But, say, this book skips along. It's like a lamb that turns out to be dead.
And there was a film made about 15 years ago of Christy Mowry's own Double Entry.
A film, it's divided opinion, because it's quite... I hate to use the phrase, but parts of it are excellent. I really like the soundtrack. I really like the performances.
Yeah.
It's the very short version is that there are scenes which are set for reasons that I don't understand, except possibly funding, in Renaissance Italy.
That's correct.
These scenes do not for me work. They're very lavish. These scenes do not for me work.
How do they squeeze that in?
Vaguely to do with the inventor of double entry bookkeeping, who was a Renaissance Italian.
Yeah.
They don't, in my opinion, don't add anything. The scenes in modern London. He actually has done, Paul Tickell, try not to sound patronising because it's a good job of work, he's made a 90s version of Christy Mowry. The factory scenes are great, Neil Stoops great, the lead's great. It's really well done, it's a nice... But it could have been done as a good naturalistic film. If I'd done it, it would be great.
I think the problem with the film is, for reasons that are perfectly understandable, they're trying to... take from the book. I mean, in theory, you could say the novel Christy Mowry's Own Double Entry is a novel about terrorism.
Yeah.
And they try and make a film that is that novel. But, of course, it isn't really a novel about terrorism. It's a novel about novels and ideas and B.S. Johnson and comedy all those other things. It's very hard
it's
to make that play.
It's more than terrorism, really.
And there's no no element in the film of saying to you, this is a film. So there's no kind of Johnsonian postmodern element in it at all.
When I read Christy Mowry, only afterwards you think, oh, hang on, he's just performed an appalling act. You're kind of shocked, but you're just like, okay, he's done that.
Yeah.
Because it kind of fits his argument.
Yeah,
you're inside his head. That's the difference.
You're inside his head, and then you sometimes
if
not
this
inside.
Was, if you film Christy Mowry as a book about terrorism, as a film about terrorism, it should be from the POV of a terrorist, who's also a nutter. He's not a political terrorist. See, in the end, Christy Mowry's a sociopath.
Mm.
He represents the side of B.S. Johnson, which is basically, I'd like all the critics and the other authors dead.
And the Double Entry book, I just love it.
He's a genius.
He's not above really crap. Kind of, it just made me laugh a lot when one of the characters says, you know, cool, would you credit it? And he says, I'd have to think about that.
I think that's a great joke. And you know what he does? He does it three times in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
So that the third time you're going,
see what he did there.
I've never noticed that. There's also the running joke of the butcher bird, the shrike.
You may not know, but some readers may in some way. Yeah, he says it's
at one point.
When it was being translated into Dutch, I was part of a B.S. Johnson internet group, and the Dutch translator wrote to him and said, can anyone explain why Christie's girlfriend is called the Shrike? The answer is because she works in a... I might as well spoil it for the world. She works in a butcher's shop.
Yeah.
She is a bird in Cockney rhyming slang, and a butcher bird is the Shrike. The Shrike is an animal that I believe... lets its prey, hangs up its prey.
Yeah, it impales them on a spike. Basically, the butcher bird, they hang there and so you can eat them later, and they often aren't dead by the time they eat them. So it's...
But if you don't... It took me a long time to find this out. It's a very involved joke. It has nothing to do with the Shrike's character, which has to be said is minimally written.
And when you think of Ponchon for
shaving foam.
Shaving foam.
When, that's another reason I enjoyed the book when I was 16.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of this practice.
It's funny, it's the first time I was introduced to it as well. It's always got this great scene where a bird... You get to shave every hair off a bird's body.
And the best thing is... It's relevant to the story.
Yeah,
it's a perfect narrative device.
Yeah.
For it is shaving foam that hastens the untimeliness of it all. Who would have thought,
David? Was Christy Mowry when you came to write your own fiction. I have to say, having not finished The Mule that long ago,
no one has. Oh, I see.
Yeah, whether he was he's one of those voices in your head when you're writing.
I think he's too good to be. I think there's a dryness of tone that he has that nobody else has. But I think it's just a kind of mulch of comedy, just confirmed aspects of comedy. If I could write anything like B.S. Johnson, I'd be a very happy man. I think that sense of humour is inside me because of reading that at such an early age.
Have you got any more tenuous links, Matthew?
Yes, I have. I've got a tenuous link for us to go out on. And there are two, actually. I've got one. I thought this week I'd try and get a tenuous link to John and to Andy. And I found one, actually. It was relatively easy to find one for both of you.
Relatively easy. I like that.
Go on. So, John, I'm going to tell you what yours is, because I think you probably know a little bit about it already, which is that 2 weeks before he died, B.S. Johnson went for a drink in the Falkland Arms, which is your local pub.
It is my local pub, yeah.
And what do you think he was doing there?
He was staying with a mutual friend of ours, a guy called Peter Buckman, who was in... takes the other book off the desk. Peter was a publisher, but also a writer. He'd written one novel called Playground, but he was a great friend of B.S. Johnson's, and he lives in Little Chew, which is the next village to Great Chew, which is where I live and where the Falkland Arms is. And when Jonathan Coe was writing his biography, Like a Fiery Elephant, he came and stayed in the pub as well, because he was interviewing Peter about B.S. Johnson. So, yeah, that's my link.
So for Andy, Matt, have you got a little bit of a prompt here that we can give him to start this off? So do you recognise this, Andy?
Or maybe open it.
It's the Kinks.
It is the Kinks.
It's Victoria by the Kinks. Well, it's a version of Victoria by the Kinks. It's the Falls.
Right, yeah.
The Falls, Victoria. Yeah.
Okay, so this is the Falls version of Victoria.
That is me.
So,
we've reached peak Miller.
And the Fall.
This is peak Miller, basically.
Go on.
What is the connection between the writer Andy Miller, the Kinks, and B.S. Johnson, bearing in mind that you've written a book about the Kinks? So,
maybe
actually, this should be.
Sunny afternoon.
I wrote a book about the Village Green Preservation Society LP.
It's not that LP. It's a different LP. But you did write about the Kinks, so you should.
Oh, okay.
I'd be surprised if you didn't know this. I'm disappointed, I suppose, would be the word.
All right. Can you tell John's what it is, though, right?
A bit harsh?
Yeah.
Go on, Andy. You've had.
There's a record. I don't know, Matthew, but there is a record by the Panisse brothers called B.S. Johnson.
Is there?
Yeah, okay. And very nice it is, too.
It's not that. It's actually something to do with Victoria. So the song Victoria is the opening track on
Arthur. Or The Decline and Fall of the British Empire by the Kinks.
And Arthur is based on... Do you know what it's based on?
It's based on Ray Davies's brother-in-law.
And it's based on a play that was written by Ray Davies and... Julian Mitchell.
Julian Mitchell, that's right.
And Julian Mitchell is one of the writers that contributed to that book on the other side of the table, London Portrait
Painters. Oh, there you go.
That is so tenuous.
There you go.
I tried to
explain this to my colleague Phil, how tenuous this thing was earlier in the week. And literally, his eyes glazed over about 5 seconds. He's completely lost. But there you have it.
I'm just waking up now, to be honest.
You're right. I'm disappointed I didn't get that, though, Matthew.
It's quite interesting set of writers on the back of this book. I mean, there's some that are probably less well-remembered than others, but Eva Figes, I suppose, is still remembered. Wilson Harris, novelist. And Rainer Heppelstall, not really remembered at all, but interesting. Olivia Manning. And then Adrian Mitchell and Julian Mitchell.
Yeah.
Piers Paul Reid, but Melvin Bragg certainly is.
And Julian Mitchell's best known, in fact, now for his work on Inspector Morse, believe it or not.
As was Peter Buckman, also wrote Peter.
Really?
Inspector Morse, yeah.
If only B.S. Johnson had written Inspector Morse.
Can you imagine?
Why are we here? You're John Thor.
Yes, you could see him being a really, really...
I know who the murderer is, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
because it's all made up.
All is chaos.
Playing good cop, bad cop. Lewis interrogates. Morse comes in. Oh, I'll call this lying.
Right. Well, on that on that happy bombshell, it's probably time to wind up. Thank you very much, David, for coming in and sharing your knowledge and love of B.S. Johnson, and to Matthew, obviously, for a link more tenuous than any we've hitherto had. This is Backlisted, at Backlisted Pod on Twitter. Do go there to follow us, or Backlisted Podcast on Facebook. And we'll see you all again next time.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.